From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Harry Belafonte on his life in music, movies, and the civil rights movement. This week, Belafonte gives his first public concert in New York in over 30 years. Also, consider this. For every life saved in the United States by not smoking, many more may be lost in Asia because of smoking, thanks in part to successful marketing campaigns by American cigarette companies. We talk with journalist Stan Sesser about exporting the Marlboro Man to Asia. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the British bestseller, The Queen and I. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Top officials of the Palestine Liberation Organization gathered in Tunis tonight to decide on a Palestinian self-rule plan in the occupied territories and a mutual recognition accord with Israel. A survey conducted by the Reuters news agency predicted that PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat would win majority support for the self-rule agreement. At the same time, Reuters reported that negotiators are still having trouble arriving at satisfactory wording on the mutual recognition statements. Speaking yesterday in Oman, Arafat said that Israel caused the delay by trying to set conditions for recognition. Israel's interior minister has resigned after Prime Minister Rabin was told by the Israeli Supreme Court to fire him and the deputy religious minister. Both have been charged with corruption. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Both ministers are from the ultra-Orthodox Shas party, which contributes 6 seats to Prime Minister Rabin's governing coalition. If the Shas party leaves the government in protest over the court decision, as seems likely, Rabin loses his Jewish majority in the Knesset. He would still have a 1-seat majority with the support of 5 Arab Knesset members, but in the past he said he does not want to be dependent on Arab votes. Reports from Tunis say PLO officials are concerned about the effects of the court decision on the government and on the PLO-Israel agreement for Palestinian self-rule in the Gaza Strip and Jericho. The party is expected to decide whether to remain in the government in the next few days. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Canadians will go to the polls October 25th to elect a new government. The elections are expected to focus on how to improve the country's weak economy. Prime Minister Kim Campbell hopes to lead her progressive Conservative Party to its third consecutive majority government. Jennifer Ludden reports.
Kim Campbell launched her campaign warning that economic problems cannot be solved overnight. She said only her party's fiscally conservative policies can eventually turn around Canada's high unemployment and decrease its debt load. She repeated her promise to eliminate the deficit, calling it a killer of jobs and everything Canadians value, and said she will not raise taxes. Campbell's policies differ little from those of her unpopular predecessor, Brian Mulroney, something her opponents are quick to point out. Liberal Party leader Jean Chrétien says new jobs must be created before addressing the deficit. He's promised government work programs if elected. Chrétien's Liberals lead in the polls, despite Campbell's greater personal popularity. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Ludden in Montreal.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 18 points to close at 3,589. Declines led advances by almost 2-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Clinton administration has proposed changes in federal safe water regulations that could raise water bills for many Americans. The changes would be offered as amendments to the existing Safe Drinking Water Act, designed to protect against water pollution. Among its proposals, the Environmental Protection Agency would authorize states to collect a user fee that would help pay the costs of overseeing safe water programs at water companies. A bipartisan group of House members who support the North American Free Trade Agreement predicted today that they will defy conventional wisdom and win approval of the controversial trade pact. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The pro-NAFTA forces face their toughest challenge in the House, where a majority of Democrats, including key members of the leadership, oppose it, and the administration will need Republican votes to win. Today, the lawmakers held a morale-raising meeting on Capitol Hill with Trade Representative Mickey Cantor and the so-called NAFTA czars, Chicago attorney Bill Daley and former Minnesota Congressman Bill Frenzel. After the meeting, California Democrat Bob Matsui, point man for the House Democrats, predicted victory.
You think that any of us are going to put our reputation on the line? Bill Daley giving up his law practice for the purpose of coming here and seeing a humiliating defeat. It's just not going to happen.
However, some pro-NAFTA Democrats acknowledged that their side lost ground during the August recess as lawmakers encountered vocal opposition to the trade pact at home. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
Airline investor Frank Lorenzo has apparently lost a round in his effort to launch a new airline called ATX Incorporated. The Department of Transportation said an administrative law judge has turned down Lorenzo's application to start the new discount fare carrier. The judge said that the proposed airline has repeatedly disobeyed his orders. Lorenzo, who ran Eastern Airlines in its final years, faces stiff opposition from airline unions. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Harry Belafonte is about to do something he hasn't done in more than 30 years, give a public concert in New York City. In the mid-50s, Belafonte popularized Caribbean calypsos for American audiences with hits like Jamaica Farewell and the Banana Boat Song.
Daylight come and me want go home. Work all night and I drink a rum.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Stack banana till the morning come.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Come Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me want.
After Belafonte's musical success, he started his Hollywood career, starring in such films as Carmen Jones, Buck and the Preacher, Odds Against Tomorrow, and Uptown Saturday Night. In the 60s, Belafonte used his financial resources to back young black artists, and he used his international popularity to strengthen the civil rights movement. He's still an international human rights activist. Belafonte was born in Harlem. His mother was from Jamaica, his father from Martinique. When he was five, his mother sent him to Jamaica. He told me why.
Well, my mother was my father was constantly away. She was, for all intents and purposes, a single parent. She was a domestic worker, a woman who was struggling to get over as an immigrant in this country. Her children were left to the whims of the neighborhood and to the streets of New York. And at a very early age, I was hit by an automobile.
Oh.
And was unconscious for a couple of days in Harlem Hospital. And that sent a horror through my mother. And she felt that I would perhaps be safer in the mountains of Jamaica than I would be in the streets of New York, and sent my brother and myself there.
What did you think of the idea of going to Jamaica?
Well, I didn't mind the idea of going to Jamaica. What really bothered me was the fact that my mother had to leave us there. And once again, there we were, thrust into the midst of strangers and people whom we didn't know, and having to make it on our own, so to speak. And plus the fact that we never stayed in one place very long. My brother and I were quite nomadic. We just went from place to place and never really established a sense of community, and never stayed long enough with one family to have ourselves in some centered place.
Were the families that you stayed with part of your extended family, or were they strangers?
Both extended family as well as some strangers.
Why didn't you stay in one place for a long time?
I think it was a matter of economics. I think some people found two additional children to their own families a bit of a burden.
Mm-hmm.
They were poor. So we were constantly shifted from place to place so that others could help share the responsibility. Some places we were just very unhappy in and didn't want to stay, and were sent to other places.
Now, how'd you get back to New York?
Well, the war broke out between England and Germany. My mother was convinced that, like many people were, that the invincible Nazi machine was going to soon conquer England. And what would happen to all of the English possessions, all of their colonies. And she feared for that and then brought us back home when I was 12. And I've been living in America ever since.
Was it hard to readjust to Harlem?
Very hard. I had an accent from the Caribbean, and I looked different, and I had this dyslexic problem that I couldn't adjust to the schools that I was in. And my mother seemed to have been very much part of that shifting from place to place to place to place. We lived all over the city, within the ghetto in which we were forced to live. And we moved from one neighborhood to another neighborhood. My mother was always chasing work and chasing places where she thought we would have better accommodations for less money. So we were constantly on the move.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Harry Belafonte. So how were you first exposed to theater?
When I came out of the Second World War, I was kind of looking for where to go and what to do. And in the interim, I became a janitor's assistant in a building. And I repaired the Venetian blinds in the apartment of a young woman by the name of Clarice Taylor, who is known by many people as the mother of Mr. Huxtable on the Bill Cosby show. And she played the good witch in The Wiz. She was the tenant in the apartment, and I repaired the Venetian blinds. She gave me two tickets to a play at a community theater called the American Negro Theater, which was at the Harlem Public Library. And I'd never been to the theater before, and I had this opportunity, so I went. And when the lights went down and the curtain opened and the players walked on, a whole new world opened up for me, and I was deeply touched and moved by it. And that's how I got into theater.
Could you explain what it was that really reached you about the performance?
I saw people of color on a stage articulating a point of view on a subject, and I found it quite magical. I found them doing things that were quite wholesome. I saw the audience respond to the moments that the play took them, either to laughter or to something very dramatic. And I saw people in motion doing things that were very positive and very creative. And I loved the rhythm of the playwright, the way language flowed, the way people answered and spoke to one another. I became totally involved. As a matter of fact, at the end of the play, I went back to thank her for the ticket. And I had to stand with a long line of people because it was the closing night of the play. And it was a repertory format. And they were getting ready to set up the next play and were taking down the sets. So I pitched in to help take down the sets. And because I was good with my hands. And when I got through doing the work, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. Clarice Taylor had left. I never told her thanks for the tickets. But I knew that I wanted to get back to this environment, to these people who were about something, who had a sense of purpose. And I didn't start off wanting to be a performer. I started off just wanting to be involved. And then they came up with a play for the text to begin to dismantle, to find out how to build a set for it. And the play was Sean O'Casey's Juno and the Peacock. And I became exposed to this Irish playwright who was, I thought, one of the most incredible writers that I'd ever read. And I had not read that much up to that point.
So when you started to study acting, how did you work on yourself to kind of transform yourself into an actor, both in terms of the craft, but also in terms of the type of person you thought an actor needed to be?
Well, when we got the play, my job was to work with a group of young men and women to build sets. And they needed someone to play the young male lead in the play, and they didn't have anybody within, either in the school at the American Negro Theater, and those who had auditioned, they found the work was somewhat unacceptable. So they asked me, would I play it? And I just, and in the spirit of teamwork, I accepted being a performer, to perform this part. And when I had to learn the words and then get into the play, then I was deeply touched by the fact that I now had an opportunity to interpret and to articulate the words of this great writer. And I wanted to do more of that, and I wanted to become proficient in the ability to be able to do that. And in order to acquire this proficiency, I had to go to an institution that was committed fully and solely to this, and it was the New School of Social Research. Erwin Piscotta, who ran the school, was a German Jew who had escaped Hitler. He was at the Max Reinhardt Theater in Germany. He introduced us to Bertolt Brecht and to Jean-Paul Sartre, and he brought a richness of literature and culture to the school. Many people sought to be in his class, and among my classmates were Marlon Brando, Walter Matthau, B. Arthur, Rod Steiger, Tony Curtis, just a bunch of us, all young kids, just starting out, or young men and women, wanting to be in theater. And it was in that environment that I developed this great love and comfortability, really, with the idea of being an actor.
Once you fell in love with theater and then got your theater training and developed into an actor, were you able to find parts?
No, that was the irony of it all. I then had to deal with racial reality. No matter how much I loved this thing, if I didn't play in the American Negro Theater or once every millennium when a black play came along, most of which were musicals, there would be no opportunity, really, on a full-time basis. So I was quite prepared to flirt with the theater and to do as much as I could in it while looking for some work that would give me the opportunity to pay the rent. Before I could even deal with that, I ran out of the federal subsidy that was given to us to learn, to be in this school.
From the GI Bill.
Yeah, GI Bill of Rights. And what happened was that I was a frequent visitor and a devotee of jazz, and a frequent visitor to a place called the Royal Roost. And I went there nightly because our school was only two blocks away from the nightclub in the middle of the heart of Broadway. And I had struck up a friendship with a young man named Monty Kay, and he was the promoter and the impresario for everything that went on in that club. And he'd heard me sing in a school play, only as an exercise for the play. And he then said to me, well, I've heard you sing. Why don't you learn a few songs? Come into the club. I'll make you an intermission singer. And during that time, you'll be able to make enough money to continue to pursue your studies in the school, if the school will then give you a scholarship. And I went to the administrators at the school, and they gave me a scholarship, and I started to sing to pay my way through school. The singing then got so popular, and people responded so strongly to it, that I feared that it would take me away from the theater. And I didn't consider myself a significantly important jazz singer. I didn't find that pop music particularly moved me to the places that I wanted to go after this heavy encounter with Shakespeare and Tolstoy and Chekhov and all the things we were doing as students. So I quit and singing, and I opened up a small restaurant with a couple of other friends with the money that I'd saved, called The Sage in Greenwich Village. And while there, studying during the day and working at night, I discovered the Village Vanguard, a nightclub in New York, which was rich with folk artists. And I discovered Lead Belly, and I discovered Big Bill Brunsey, and I discovered Pete Seeger, and I discovered Woody Guthrie. And much to my amazement and delight, I discovered Josh White. I saw these men and women singing songs that came from all walks of life. It wasn't just songs about unrequited love. They were filled with drama. They were filled with characters. They were filled with parables and metaphor. And I saw in that the opportunity to apply my acting skills. And since I had a voice that was fairly comfortable to listeners, that I would then have the instrument to be able to do this. And I began to develop a repertoire. And with that, I then opened at the Village Vanguard. And I just haven't looked back since.
My guest is Harry Belafonte. Tomorrow night, he gives his first public performance in New York City in over 30 years. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Harry Belafonte is with us. You were really one of the first people from the entertainment world to become active within the civil rights movement. Was there a period that was a turning point or a consciousness-raising period for you?
Yes. When I was born.
Okay.
And it was later on exercised even more when the war came, Second World War, and I got into it. And America propagandized us about ending totalitarianism and ending fascism and ending racial superiority and ending anti-Semitism and making the world perfect for a meaningful future. And I believed that. And when I came back to my home, after having done a tour of duty and the war ended, we expected that there was going to be some reward for all that we had done. Just little things like taking down the segregation signs as a gift to those of us who fought to make America safe and to end the world tyranny. And that didn't happen. And the option was to acquiesce and to go back to business as usual, or to use our strength and our energy to make sure that America would never be comfortable in going back to business as usual. And I decided that that's what I would do as an artist and as a human being and as a person. And that was when my activism started. A lot of people who did not know that part of my life have made assumptions that it wasn't until I became famous that I then turned to social and political activity. But that's not true. Paul Robeson was a mentor of mine. I tried to pattern my life after what I saw him do, his dignity, his strength, his courage. Dr. Du Bois was someone whom I sought out, and I met him accidentally, and I sought him out afterwards and listened to him speak and listened to his thoughts. He was one of the greatest intellects that this country ever produced, and certainly one of the greatest in the black community. And in that environment, these men were great social thinkers. Eleanor Roosevelt became a friend of mine, and she too had her own thoughts on social and political conditions.
How did you meet Martin Luther King?
He called me. I was in New York, and he was coming here to visit for the first time in Harlem at Adam Clayton Powell's church, the Abyssinian. And he was talking to a group of people from the clergy. And I asked, would I meet him after that meeting? And I said, yes. And we met in the basement of the church, and we talked.
And you became pretty good friends?
Very good friends. We became very, very close. After I spoke to him in the room and he told me of his mission and what he hoped to be able to achieve, albeit he didn't know quite where the path would lead us, but he knew that it was a fight that had to be made and he needed everyone he could get, and asked me if I would join, I said, yes, I would.
What are your priorities now, both politically and artistically?
Well, I'd like to focus very heavily on my artistic interests and to put them in the service of social and political ideas. I'm getting ready to do a film with Jonathan Demme. As a matter of fact, it'll be his next film, the director of Silence of the Lambs and others. We bought the rights to a book called Parting the Waters, written by Taylor Branch.
This is a history of the civil rights movement.
That's right, and it was the Pulitzer Prize of 1989, so we bought that book, and we're doing it for TriStar. And Jonathan will direct, and Ed Saxon, Jonathan, and myself will produce.
Will you perform in it? Will you act?
Well, we're examining the script. There's several parts that I could play, but I don't want to put the piece out of balance.
Mm-hmm.
And neither does Jonathan. And
I guess at the least you could do a cameo as yourself.
Yeah, but that was 30 years ago.
Well, oh, true, right. Good point.
Although people tell me I haven't changed much, but I think that's more flattery than reality.
Right.
And then I'm doing a film with Robert Altman, Bob Altman,
uh-huh,
called Kansas City, in which I'll play a part. And then he and I are also developing a second film right after that called Cork, C-O-R-K, which is an examination of racial conditions in America, racial practices, racism, and all of its attendant parts, through the view of minstrelly, through the view of blackface, through mm-hmm. the view of what blackface meant in the Amos and Andy world. And it's a It's a rather delicate place in which to be, but it's fraught with great adventure and possibilities, and we're doing that. Then I'm doing a film for Turner, Ted Turner, and his new film company called The Port Chicago Mutiny, which has to do with 50 sailors during the Second World War who were charged with mutiny for refusing to obey an order that they should never have been given. And, of course, mutiny in the time of war was punishable by death. And these racist officers did their utmost to railroad these men, brought them to trial. They were convicted, but it has since been viewed as a thoroughly unjust act on the part of the Navy Department. And Turner brought the property to me, and I will be directing it.
Oh.
So it was another opportunity. But what I want to do, to be very succinct, is I want to use my time, my relationships, to deal more deeply into my artistic interests, to reflect my social and political ideas and thoughts.
You're about to perform in New York. How do you feel about the old songs that you recorded in the 50s?
I feel very good about them. I thought there were songs that were very much instructive. I thought they brought people to places that they had never been before. I think it makes them take focus on a group of people in a region that they perhaps knew nothing about. Paul Robeson once said to me, get people to sing your song and they must, then they'll be required to know who you are.
Do you think your voice has changed much over the years?
My voice has changed a lot over the years. I never had any formal vocal training. And as the state of the art developed and electronic music became more demanding and commanding, the voice gets heavier. I think it matures. Or gets older. And I find my singing style different because I get more energy and I get more drama behind things that I want to do by hitting notes and hitting lyrics a certain way that I wouldn't have done in an earlier approach where I was far more lyrical and far more, you know, had a tone that was far more refined than the ones I choose to use now. I could get back to that sound if I wanted to, but I don't see any particular virtue in that.
Mm-hmm. There's a certain raspiness to your speaking voice. Does that come through in your singing voice, too, now?
No, because I engage different muscles. When I sing, my diaphragm kicks in more fully, and I project more fully. I'm prone to talk softly, and air escapes because of a tilted larynx, which I have, which permits air to come out in a free-flow, uncontrolled way that I would not ordinarily have were my larynx straight. But it was an act of birth. And as a matter of fact, the print of my voice I like very much. It's like Louis Armstrong or mm-hmm. others who have a voice that's just very different from everyone else's. And what it forced me to do was to interpret material in a way that would accommodate this impediment or this imperfection and therefore gave me a very unique approach to my singing that people liked, and I loved it. And I took great confidence in the fact that one did not need... I think if you've got it, you should sound like a Pavarotti or sound like a Leontine Price or whatever. But when I heard people like Walter Houston sing, who had mm-hmm. a gruffy voice, and mm-hmm. when I listened to other singers, I was confident that I could move comfortably in the world of art and be accepted for what I was.
I want to thank you very much for telling us some of your story. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Harry Belafonte performs tomorrow through Saturday at Avery Fisher Hall in New York. I'm Jerry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Down the way where the nights are gay and the sun shines daily on the mountain top, I took a trip on a sailing ship, and when I reached Jamaica, I made a stop. But I'm sad to say I'm on my way. Won't be back for many a day. My heart is down, my head is turning around. I had to leave a little girl in Kingston Town.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, why Asia is becoming Marlboro country. Restrictions on smoking and tobacco advertising in the U.S. have created problems for American tobacco companies, but they've been opening new markets in Asia with the help of the U.S. government. We'll talk with Stan Sesser, who reports on this in the current edition of The New Yorker. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new British export, The Queen and I, a novel by Sue Townsend that has the royal family deposed and on the dole. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Bosnia's Muslim President Alija Izetbegovic is in Washington, seeking more support from President Clinton and Secretary of State Warren Christopher. Izetbegovic met with President Clinton this evening. Barry Schweid has details.
Izetbegovic's main demands already have U.S. support. 35%, not 31% of Bosnian territory, a corridor to the Adriatic from Sarajevo, more land in the southwestern part of the country. But even if the Serbs and Croats decide to be more flexible when and if negotiations resume in Geneva, the Muslims of Bosnia still will have lost ground in the 17-month war, and the former Yugoslav Republic effectively will be partitioned. The administration is trying to put the emphasis on the plight of civilians, thousands of them forced from their homes and ethnic cleansing, for there is no evidence the Allies, led by France and Britain, are willing under present circumstances to approve a NATO military attack on the Serbs or to permit the Muslims to get weapons. Izetbegovic's visit and his appeal, therefore, may have only limited success. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
A Transportation Department judge has recommended the agency deny Frank Lorenzo's application to start up a new discount airline called ATX. The judge said the proposal was viable, but he said ATX representatives defied his orders and filed some frivolous items on the application. He said that makes him doubt ATX would comply with federal air traffic regulations. Dr. Joycelyn Elders was sworn in today as Surgeon General after conservative Republicans in the Senate failed to sidetrack her nomination. The Senate approved Elders by a vote of 65-34. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
13 Republicans joined 52 Democrats in voting for Elders, defeating an effort by conservatives to derail the nomination. Her opponents criticized her outspoken support of abortion and sex education for teenagers and managed to delay the vote until after the month-long congressional recess. They tried again to defeat her, raising controversial statements she's made in the past. After the Senate approved her confirmation, Elders said she chooses to look forward and not back. "I am by training and by temperament," she said, "a healer." Elders will be sworn in at a formal White House event next week. She succeeds Antonia Novello, who was appointed by President Bush. She's the daughter of a sharecropper. She is a pediatrician and former medical school professor and director of the Arkansas Health Department. Senator Edward Kennedy described her as a diamond in the rough. Her opponents see the rough, he said, but miss the diamond. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Senate has approved a much smaller version of President Clinton's National Service Plan. The $1.5 billion program would give students college aid in exchange for community service. The president's original plan was more than 10 times bigger than the Senate version. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 18 points. This is NPR News. Israel is keeping quiet about a report that it will give the Golan Heights back to Syria. An Israeli newspaper quotes PLO leader Yasser Arafat, saying Israel has agreed to withdraw from the region. Israel captured the Golan in the 1967 Mideast War. Arafat says there's a firm understanding between Israel and Syria to return the entire territory within 10 years. The medical treatment for the rare disease ALD that was featured in the movie Lorenzo's Oil has been tried on adults but has failed to stop the fatal illness from progressing. Christopher Joyce has more.
The Hollywood drama was based on the true story of Lorenzo O'Donnell, whose nervous system was slowly being destroyed by the inherited disease. Lorenzo's parents treated him with a special diet. The diet includes a cocktail of exotic oils that help rid the nervous system of harmful fatty acids. Lorenzo is still alive, but when doctors tried Lorenzo's oil on other children with the disease, They found no evidence that it works. So scientists tried it on adults with the disease. Researchers in France report in tomorrow's New England Journal of Medicine that they saw no improvement in 24 people with the disease who tried the oil over a 2-year period. An accompanying editorial in the journal says Hollywood was premature in suggesting that Lorenzo's oil works. This is Christopher Joyce reporting.
A new Education Department report says about 90 million American adults, or nearly half the adult population, have very poor reading, writing, and math skills. The report says 47 million of those have such limited skills they're unable to function well on the job. Young adults had lower literacy skills than their age group did 8 years ago. Congress ordered the study. The White House is proposing changes in the Safe Water Drinking Act to make the nation's water supply cleaner. An extra fee on people's water bills would finance the changes. EPA Administrator Carol Browner announced the proposals today. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Marlboro, Winston, Salem, and Kent have become familiar names throughout Asia. You can see their logos on billboards, in magazine ads, on blue jeans, and travel bags. My guest Stan Sesser writes about Asia for The New Yorker. In the current edition, he reports on how American tobacco companies are opening new markets in Asia as they face increasing restrictions on smoking in the U.S. In just 1 week, Sesser attended a Virginia Slims fashion show at a Taiwanese disco, watched the finals of the Salem Open Tennis Tournament in Hong Kong, and followed the Marlboro Cycle Tour in the Philippines. In Shanghai, he heard the Marlboro theme on the radio.
I was introduced to the Marlboro ad campaign by a professor of medicine at the Shanghai Medical Faculty, and we were sitting in a dining room eating with other medical professors, and she had a battered old transistor radio on the table. And it was an hour of Elvis Presley music in the middle of Shanghai. It was called the American Music Hour and sponsored by Marlboro Cigarettes. And after about every two Elvis Presley songs, the music stopped. And then there was this theme song from The Magnificent Seven, which is the Marlboro theme song. And then a voice in Chinese describing these cowboys. And you heard cows mooing and horses and everything. It sounded very, very out of place in Shanghai, which is the idea. The cowboy image has proved fabulously successful in Asia. And the fact that this came about, despite the fact that advertising of cigarettes is not allowed on the media in China, got these professors really outraged, and that's why they wanted me to hear it.
So foreign cigarettes aren't permitted to be sold in China except to foreigners. And even to foreigners, foreign cigarettes are only sold in hotels, airports, and government-run friendship stores. So how does Marlboro get around this?
Well, first of all, lots of foreign cigarettes are available in China. It's just on the black market. They have these wicker baskets on virtually every street corner that are overturned. And on the top of the basket, there's a crushed cigarette carton. And that's the sign that you're supposed to ask about cigarettes. And then you say, I want Marlboro cigarettes. I mean, you say it in Chinese. And the guy scurries off and gets the Marlboro cigarettes, which are hidden somewhere else. So if the authorities come up, there's nothing under the basket. And you buy the Marlboro cigarettes for Chinese currency. Now, Philip Morris is not happy about this arrangement. They'd make a lot more money selling them directly. But as it happens, a lot of people in China smoke Marlboros, and you can get them any place, but just on the black market. It's part of the whole authority of the central government collapsing in China. And I understand that since I was in China in May, that starting this summer, the black market has actually moved into stores. You can now just walk into a retail shop and buy illegal Marlboro cigarettes. You don't even have to go through the subterfuge of the wicker basket.
So have you found a direct correlation between the limitations put on cigarette advertising in the United States and the drop-off in smoking in the United States because of health concerns? Have you found a correlation between that and the inroads the American tobacco companies are trying to make in other countries?
Well, there's no question when you read tobacco trade publications, there's no question that the industry is moving to Asia to gain back what they're losing in the United States. And they're doing it with amazing success. In with the aid of the U.S. government, they've already gotten into Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and Thailand. And sales of American cigarettes are soaring. If you read Philip Morris's annual report, you see that their international sales far outweigh any drop-off. They've just expanded by 50% the capacity of their cigarette plant in North Carolina because they can't keep up with the demand in Asia. So when we think of the lives that are being saved in the United States from people who quit smoking or who don't take it up, who would have in previous years, for every life saved in the United States, tens or perhaps hundreds of lives are going to be lost in Asia.
Do people in Asia not know about the research correlating cigarettes and lung cancer and other health problems that's been conducted in the United States?
Yeah, it goes back almost to what I remember from the United States, say, in the 1960s when the Surgeon General's report first came out. And some people are paying attention, but that's people who read and people who are concerned about their health and whatever, and it's just a small segment of society, and it takes decades for the consciousness to really pervade the society. Even in the United States, you know, that consciousness has still not pervaded many minority groups, and cigarette companies are turning their attention now to blacks and Hispanics, and while smoking rates are dropping, smoking rates among black women, for instance, are increasing. It takes a long, long time, and you know, the societies in Asia are not nearly as educated as those in the United States, and unfortunately for their health, but fortunately for other things, Asian societies are becoming wealthier, and now, you know, those hundreds of millions of peasants who could not participate previously in a market economy now have enough money to buy cigarettes.
In some Asian countries, it was really basically men who smoke, not women. But you say that the American tobacco companies are trying to open up the female market.
Yeah, I went to a fashion show, a Virginia Slims fashion show in a disco in Taipei. And it's very unusual in many Chinese societies to see women smoke. But when you get to the upper crust of the relatively westernized Taipei society, you see Chinese women smoking all over the place. And there's no particular reason that women aren't supposed to smoke in Asia, except it's never been done. And just the suggestion that they can be fashionable like all those fashionable Westerners merely by lighting up a cigarette is proving a tremendous lure for women.
My guest is Stan Sesser, and we're discussing his article that appears in the current issue of The New Yorker magazine. The article's called Opium War Redux. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Stan Sesser is my guest, and we're talking about the subject of his current New Yorker magazine article on the inroads the American tobacco industry has made in Asia. You say that American cigarette companies have gotten help from the American government in opening up Asian markets. What has the American government done to help the tobacco companies?
Well, the American government, it's very interesting that for instance, not a grain of American rice can be sold today in Taiwan or Japan, which would be tremendous markets for the American rice industry. But American cigarettes can be sold, and that's because the tobacco lobby in Washington is so powerful. And the Reagan and Bush administrations pushed very hard and really played hardball with these countries. To get cigarettes into Japan and Taiwan and South Korea and Thailand, they threatened massive trade retaliation. You do this or else. And then not only the American government, and this is the U.S. trade representative, who handles the negotiation, that's the federal agency, the American government not only insisted that these countries open their market to American cigarettes, but they insisted that these countries drop all advertising and health restrictions so that American cigarettes could compete on an equal footing. For instance, Taiwan did not allow advertising of cigarettes. And when the U.S. bludgeoned Taiwan into admitting American cigarettes in 1986, Taiwan was also forced to allow cigarette advertising so that the American cigarettes could establish a market. And then the U.S. Trade Representative maintained total vigilance over any attempt by the Asian governments to impose health regulations. And for instance, in 1990, when Taiwan wanted to, they had a tiny little health warning on the side of their pack, and they wanted to move it into the front of the pack and enlarge the type, the U.S. government formally protested, claiming that they had no right under the 1986 agreement to move the warning to the front of the pack. And that would discourage the sale of American cigarettes. The warning, of course, applied to all cigarettes, Taiwanese as well as American. And they had to have long negotiations, and finally the U.S. government let them move the warning to the front of the pack, but they weren't allowed to enlarge the type. At the same time that the government is trying to discourage smoking in the United States, the Reagan and Bush administrations were forcing Asian governments to not implement health regulations.
What was the motivation of the Reagan and Bush administrations in working so hard to help American tobacco companies open up new markets in Asia?
Well, I found a really interesting symbolic thing when I investigated that, which is there's a room very near to the Secretary of State's office on the seventh floor of the State Department building called the Treaty Room, where formal treaties are signed and where visitors are greeted and foreign dignitaries are greeted in very formal ceremonies. And in the late 80s, that room was renovated, and the tobacco industry paid the entire cost of renovating that room. And on the columns of the room are motifs of tobacco leaves. This is just symbolic of the integration of the tobacco lobby into United States politics. The Southern senators, the tobacco lobbyists in Washington, Michael Deaver, when he left the Reagan administration, became a tobacco lobbyist. The tremendous power of the industry, and the industry decided it was too hot politically to be as blatant as they had been before pushing things in the United States, although I don't know, they're still pretty blatant. But they decided to use the American government to bludgeon their way into Asia. And they gave the orders, and the American government wagged its tail.
The new trade representative in the Clinton administration is Mickey Cantor. Will he have big decisions awaiting him and the issue of American tobacco overseas?
The best thing that happened in terms of anti-smoking forces is Mickey Cantor's appointment. Because Mickey Cantor, as a lawyer in Los Angeles, was a tobacco industry lawyer. I mean, he represented a lot of tobacco industry clients. And he fought to overturn, for instance, the ordinance in Beverly Hills that banned smoking in restaurants. And did some pretty outrageous things. But Mickey Cantor is also a very smart person, and I don't think he personally favors smoking. And I think he recognizes that he could drag the Clinton administration, which after all banned smoking in the White House and is going to impose a big tax on cigarettes in the United States, he could drag them into scandal by continuing to do the bidding of the tobacco industry. So Mickey Cantor told me that there are going to be changes, and one of the first changes is that the Clinton administration will no longer bar Asian countries from enacting health regulations. It's very generous of them. Taiwan is now free to put the cigarette warning at any size type it wants.
The World Health Organization is concerned about the growth of smoking in Asia. What do they have to say about it?
When you look at the World Health Organization report, it's almost inconceivable. I mean, the reason that this really hasn't been written about is that the statistics just it gets to the realm where you just you can't believe these figures. The World Health Organization looked at the growth of cigarette smoking in developing nations, most of them in Asia. And they concluded the mortality, the deaths from cigarette smoking follows the increase in smoking rates by 20, 30, 40 years as people develop cancer and other diseases. And the World Health Organization projected this into the next century. And they concluded that there would be an epidemic that would take more lives than every previous epidemic in world history combined. The number of people whose lives would prematurely end from cigarette-induced deaths would exceed the death from every epidemic in world history combined.
Have you ever been a smoker?
Never. Cigarettes have always been repugnant to me, and I've written about the subject before in other ways, but I've never seen anything as scandalous as what's going on in Asia today. And we feel pretty smug sitting in the United States and watching city after city enact anti-smoking regulations, barring smoking in restaurants and whatever. And we feel pretty smug that something's being done about the problem. And yet, as I said, for every American life saved, tens or maybe hundreds of Asian lives will be lost.
Stan Susser, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Stan Susser writes about American cigarette companies in Asia in the current edition of The New Yorker. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, your colleague Robert Siegel is in Israel. What's he reporting on?
Today he is in the Gaza Strip talking to Jewish settlers who are living in the area and have, of course, very grave concerns about this peace agreement, which is going to change their lives. We'll also be talking to an economist who is part of a team that is planning for the prosperity they hope will follow the peace plan in the Middle East. We have a story from Virginia on the lesbian couple which lost custody of one of the women's children. The abortion pill is being used for other medical purposes. We'll have a story on that and on The First Grade Goes Back to School.
Thanks, Linda. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Sue Townsend's cheeky political satire, The Queen and I, has been a bestseller in Britain ever since it was published there last year. It's just landed on these shores. But commentator Maureen Corrigan says, unlike other popular British literary imports, she doesn't expect The Queen and I to be serialized on Masterpiece Theatre anytime soon.
The most fascinating thing to me about the British royal family is that they really seem to believe they're royal. I mean, I'm an Anglophile, so whenever PBS runs one of those specials like A Day in the Life of Queen Elizabeth or Prince Charles on Church Architecture, I'm there, glued to the screen. And I've never once gotten the sense that when the cameras stop rolling, the royals ever mutter something like, "What a bloody load of rubbish." No, they are absolutely unironic about their exalted place in the great chain of being. But if the royal family suddenly had to start wearing blue collars, would they still think of themselves as blue bloods? That's the identity question Sue Townsend considers in her wicked novel, The Queen and I. When Queen Elizabeth is deposed by an upstart band of Republicans, she and the whole Windsor clan have to load their tiaras into a rent-a-truck and relocate to a squalid London housing project. As for the issue of whether royal identity is a product of nature or nurture, well, I'll give you a hint. Before the first week is up, the Queen could teach the artful Dodger some slum survival tricks. author Sue Townsend, who's from a working-class background, clearly has little use for the royal parasites. But she also knows laughter is sometimes a better weapon for waging class warfare than righteous editorializing. The Queen and I brims over with that kind of silly yet devastating humor the Brits do so well. It reads like a George Orwell essay written by Benny Hill. Consider some of the drastic, totally plausible changes that rock the royal family once they begin life on the dole. Queen Elizabeth, now plain old Liz Windsor, confronts the mysteries of how to boil water and fasten her own bra. Charles throws himself into the simpler life he's always craved. He grows organic tomatoes and a ponytail. Princess Diana, who unfortunately plays only a minor role in this novel, learns how to dress for adversity. While in the garbage-strewn streets outside, the Queen's favorite corgi runs wild with a pack of mongrels. Townsend saves some of her most satiric swats for the ordinary people who can't quite shed their habits of servility. One morning, the Queen's next-door neighbor, Beverly Threadgold, tries to work up her courage to start a conversation, but she's too petrified. After all, Beverly asks herself, how do you talk to someone whose head you were used to licking and sticking on an envelope? Throughout The Queen and I kept thinking about what critic Christopher Hitchens said about the royal family in his 1990 polemic entitled The Monarchy. Hitchens claims the royals are no mere figureheads, but rather shadowy manipulators of the democratic process. He says, humans should not worship other humans at all, but if they must do so, it is better that the worshipped ones do not occupy any positions of political power. Maybe Sue Townsend has finally put the Windsors and the Waleses where they belong.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Queen and I by Sue Townsend. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tui, with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Devin Reif is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, 250,000 years of history preserved in an ice core. We talk with scientist Paul Majewski, who heads the Greenland Ice Sheet Project. And novelist Amy Tan talks with us about making the Joy Luck Club into a movie. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.